Cervantes maybe wasn't given the respect that he, when I was in high school and even in college, you know, that people were not talking about this so much as the first novel. My name is Dan Schwartz. I've been writing and teaching at Cornell for 55 years. So I'm delighted to be here. And I hope what I do is in a teacherly fashion and to open up a little bit the doors and windows of how I read, what I read, and how it pertains to Cervantes' Don Quixote.
My name is Howard Mensing. I became interested in Don Quixote when I first read the full novel in graduate school. I knew that that was the thing that I had to devote my time to. So my dissertation was on the subject of Don Quixote and chivalry. That then became my first book, The Chivalric World of Don Quixote. I've since published the Cervantes Encyclopedia, which I have been told is the longest work in English on Don Quixote by a single author. Then with teaching it all the time, probably have read the entire novel about 35 or 40 times. The experience with Don Quixote is absolutely unique. It is a unique book, and it has been a privilege to have the opportunity to dedicate a lifetime to it, and I have not a single regret about that at all.
Thanks for tuning in to The Global Novel. I'm Claire Hennessy. Don Quixote is a Spanish epic novel by Miguel de Cervantes. It was originally published in two parts, in 1605 and 1615. It is the most generative work of fiction of all time. There are literally thousands of works of fiction, theater, poetry, and music inspired, based on, or dealing in other ways with Cervantes' novel. Don Quixote has been depicted by more artists than any other fictional character, which is part of the reason why he's the most easily recognized fictional character. A founding work of Western literature, Don Quixote is often labeled as the first modern novel and one of the greatest works ever written. It is also one of the most translated books in the world and the best-selling novel of all time. Welcome to The Global Novel, Dan and Howard, and thank you so much for joining us today. Well, Dan, you mentioned in your book that Lady Gaga once had said, "I believe magic is real. I believe fantasy is real. I live halfway between reality and fantasy all the time," which truly echoes Cervantes' ideal of the novel. Could you tell us what is so enigmatic about the character Don Quixote and why being quixotic strikes such a deep chord in readers at the time and even nowadays?
Well, we all enjoy imagining where we're not and entering into imagined worlds. And Don Quixote certainly does take us into the fantasy world. So it also is a book that worries about when we drift into a world that's not real. It wants to strike a balance because the debate, in some ways, the point of departure, it's really a critique of chivalry and the, you know, and it takes us into a world where truth and fiction, fantasy, and reality are all up for grabs. In other words, we like to believe that there's the good and the beautiful. But in fact, he calls that into question. So I think that particularly in this politically fraught time where people are enmeshed in conspiracy theories and totemized people who disagree with them, as evil, he's explaining to us that there's really, this is a relative world. And remember, he's writing in a world which was an absolute world. Mm-hmm. He's writing 100 years or so after the Inquisition, and which was really continued by Philip III. So he's really calling into question absolutism. In other words, he's really speaking to some extent for moral relativism. I mean, the Don is a sympathetic character in some ways, but he's also a fool. We're really told to kind of empathize to an extent with the Don, particularly when he becomes a victim, but he's also a fool. And it's all very well to think your neighbor who's a peasant is absolutely beautiful, but to be fighting battles on the side of fantasy and hurting real people is maybe not so good. So I think that we live in that world, but I think this book is in some ways a warning. yes, it's fun to take a vacation and vacate your daily self, but it also can be dangerous to other people. He's actually, most people don't even read the second plot, the later plot, but he's actually more sympathetic there because he's more a victim of, say, the Duke and the Duchess. And he's also more sensible when he talks about governance to Sancho Panza. He actually comes back, I think, a little bit more to the real world. But certainly, leaving this world is not so good. And one of the things about reading, and it's certainly true of Don Quixote, and one reason it's often thought of as the first novel, reading imaginative literature takes you into worlds not your own. And in fact, it allows you to see other people's points of view, to live in another place in another time. But Don Quixote is a reader. He's read these chivalric texts, and he's it's taken his mind astray. Mm-hmm. So we also have to realize that when we read, not to believe everything. What Don Quixote teaches us, among other things, is he has a kind of radial center. And we must, to understand this book, draw a circumference of judgment. Mm-hmm. On one hand, we're sympathetic with this decent guy. But on the other hand, we have to realize that he's taken us astray. And that his grammar of motives, that is following his own quixotic ideas, may not be the best for everybody. And he wants us to see that. I think it begins, you know, the point, the alpha and omega of this book is really to be aware of the balance between fiction and reality. So it's certainly true. Lady Gaga herself followed the Don sometimes in creating her own reality. She actually is a young Italian girl who went to an upper class private school in New York. But we all can't follow Lady Gaga and be as outrageous as she is, right? There's a warning there as well.
Right. Well, Howard, before we're on air, you told me how popular Don Quixote has become in the world of literature today. According to this 2002, the Norwegian Book Club, which is a group affiliated with the Nobel Prize organization, that Don Quixote had an overwhelming win among writers. So what do you think are the reasons that a work has achieved such enormous popularity for novelistic inspiration?
For a novel that sophisticated to have been written as early as 1605, it is quite stunning. It's a modern novel in every way. And every generation of novelists finds their roots in Don Quixote. The 18th century British novel with Fielding and Smollett and Sterne all go directly back to the master Don Quixote. Fielding even says he writes Joseph Andrews in imitation of the manner of Cervantes. In the 19th century, virtually all the great novelists, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, Flaubert, Pérez Galdós in Spain, Dickens, George Eliot, and so forth in English, everybody cites Don Quixote. In the 20th century, the early modernists, the mid-century writers, the post-structuralists and metafictional writers all cite Don Quixote. John Barth, for example, the American novelist, whose great novel Tidewater Tales is explicitly related to Don Quixote, wrote in one of his essays that Cervantes was the first postmodern writer. I mean, he's contemporary for everyone. Every generation of writers in every country always seem to feel that they relate to him more than to any other writer. And that was borne out in that survey that you cited. 100 of the world's greatest writers were polled and asked to name the writers who most impressed them and that they most admired. And Cervantes won with 50% more votes than the runner-up. I mean, that's an extraordinary distance. The runner-up, by the way, was Marcel Proust. So it means that for every two Prousts, there are three Cervanteses, or three Quixotes. So I think that Don Quixote is, in a way, the most comprehensive of novels, too. It's a realistic novel. It's got high elements of romance. It's a comic novel. It's a parody. It's a psychological novel. It's a philosophical novel. It's a comic novel. It's a metafictional novel. The characters know that they're characters in a book and so forth. So that you can see why every generation, every time they revise their concept of what a novel might be, Cervantes has done it. And you can't say that about anyone else. You can't say that, for example, about Shakespeare with theater, and certainly not with any other novelist.
Right. Could you please enlighten us what chivalry means for individuals and their Spanish society at the time of Don Quixote?
Yeah, well, first of all, remember that in the 16th century, Spain was the most dominant military economic power in the world. They had explored and settled huge parts of the world that had been previously unknown. In the early 16th century, ships arriving from the New World would have tales of extraordinary animals and encounters and people and buildings and structures and so forth. The entrance into the Aztec capital was described as something right out of a book of chivalry, the romances of chivalry that were so popular in Spain and Europe in the 16th century. And so Spain lived chivalry. Spain, more than any other country, lived that kind of adventuresome life. And, of course, that had its roots in the medieval reconquest, as it was called, taking back from the Arabs, who in 711 just dominated the Iberian Peninsula, winning that land back for Christianity. So chivalry was on everyone's mind. Furthermore, the greatest book of chivalry ever written was Amadís de Gaula, published in the early 16th century. It had 19 editions in Spain. It inspired multiple sequels and imitations. It and its sequels were translated. They were published and read more often in France and Italy than they were in Spain. In fact, I recently published something that indicated that there were probably 600 editions of books involving Amadís and his descendants and so forth. Over a million people read that novel and its sequels in the 16th and early 17th century. It was the first true massive international bestseller in the age of print. And so that was Don Quixote's favorite book, obviously. And he decides he wants to be a knight. And so he shines up his armor. He invents names. He imagines scenarios. He goes out. And sure enough, his first adventures, everyone seems to confirm that he is the knight that he believes he is. In my first book, The Chivalric World of Don Quixote, I tried to trace his belief in himself as a knight-errant on an outline that depends on the way he speaks. That is, he early in the novel especially, he spoke in a way that is explicitly in imitation of the archaic style of the romances of chivalry. Well, that fades as the novel goes along. People stop acting in confirmation of what he's doing. Things go wrong. He has to come up with excuses. He's brilliant with excuses. The best one is the enchanters did it. And by the end of the first part of the novel, the part that was published in 1605, people were creating scenarios for him. His friends enchant him, in quotes, in order to lock him up in a cart and take him home. They stage things for him. The second part, published 10 years later in 1605, he doesn't seem to have any interest in chivalry until he's told that a Moor an Arab, has written the first part. It's been published, and he's already a famous knight in books that people are reading. And Don Quixote asks, well, does the author promise anything more? And the answer is yes. So he figures, I have to do it. It's going to be written again. I have no choice. But in part two, he never transforms reality the way he did in part one. He's constantly manipulated and deceived by others until he finally comes to the point where he gives up. But then he meets a duke and duchess who entertain him lavishly at their home and provide elaborate scenarios based on things that happen in romances of chivalry and deceive him even more. Finally, a friend from his hometown comes and defeats him in combat and tells him that instead of killing him, he'll let him go home for a year. And so he gives up. He's a man of his word. And so he gives up and goes home, falls ill and dies. So if you take chivalry out of Don Quixote's life, you don't have anything. It is the key on which the first novel is established and based, and then the first novel becomes the base for the second novel. So I think that readers who aren't very familiar with the Spanish romances of chivalry only get a hint of that. But when you know a little bit about those romances, know a little bit about Spanish style and rhetoric of the period, you can see Don Quixote just beginning at a high level and declining as a knight-errant. He starts out, chapter one is knighthood exalted. Number two, knighthood compromised. Third chapter, knighthood defeated. Second part, knighthood imposed and knighthood denied, because he renounces chivalry at the end on his deathbed. So it's a five phase development in his work. People who don't know Spanish and people who think that the novel was invented in England in the 18th century look for ways to make Don Quixote less than a novel. Oh, it's just a parody. Oh, it's just a silly book. Oh, it's just a satire. Oh, it's a picaresque. Oh, it's episodic. Oh, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it's all of those things, but it's a lot more too. And so if you identify one of those things and say that's what it is, then it doesn't look like much of a novel compared to Henry Fielding. But if you look at all of it, it's a novel that dwarfs Henry Fielding and Richardson and Defoe and so forth. It is a unique book, and it has been a privilege to have the opportunity to dedicate a lifetime to it, and I have not a single regret about that at all.
Right. Well, Dan, this is what you wrote in your book. You mentioned Christopher Benfey's observation that getting lost appears to be a major theme in European literature. Not only Don Quixote in his adventures, but also his creator and his narrators, and even the reader experienced long detours on the journey through the text. So how do we understand some of the major narratorial techniques, such as digressions and multiple perspectives? In other words, what does Don Quixote teach us about the novel form?
Well, he certainly introduces multiple narration, which is really something that becomes more a factor in 20th century fiction. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in 20th century art with something like cubism. So he mm-hmm. certainly has us thinking about narrators. I mean, you start off, I mean, it's not entirely possible to schematize what's happening here, in my judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, people have tried to schematize Swan's Way and Proust, and it's easier to do that than it is here. And I think part of it comes from the oral tradition, and partly because he has no models, and I'm not sure he's too concerned about it. There's the character in the prologue who's talking to his friend, and he seems to be the translator, narrator. Mm-hmm. And then you read about eight chapters, and you come upon Hamet. Hamet seems to be the person who first found this manuscript in Arabic. And then somebody apparently translated it back into Spanish. And that could be the person speaking. But, and then of course there's a...
We hope you have enjoyed the episode so far. If you want to hear the entire episode, you can subscribe at theglobalnovel.com/subscribe. Thank you so much for listening.